all these ethereal organizations that come from the knowledgeable people over who live in the Himalayas, and they have all sorts of terms for the ascended masters. And Constance Gumby can tell you a great deal more about this than I can. But I've read enough of the Masonic lore to know the tremendous impact that these people have had on our society and on the societies of Europe. Certainly, you can follow the track of Masonry in America in the 1820s. When Captain Morgan was going to publish the secrets of the Masons, and he was taken out in a lake and killed, and his body was dumped. And in fact, at that time, the anti-Masonic party arose, and I think the number of Masons in America went from some 300,000 down to about 30,000, and you know, this thing really began falling apart. Now, most people don't, most Masons of today do not understand this, but the Masons have been working within our government for many, many years. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a Mason, and he began packing the American Supreme Court with people who believed in the separation of church and state, because you see, these people are anti-Christian. They're not against the occult beliefs. They're not against the occult philosophies. They're not against Lucifer. They're simply anti-Christian. And of course, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was followed by Harry Truman, who was an avowed and openly practicing a Mason. And he wasn't one of these people who got an honorary degree. He had been Mason all of his life. He, in fact, in his wallet, he carried a poem by Tennyson, which talked about this idea of this new world order, the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. And so they packed the Supreme Court. And of course, when Truman went out in 1952, then Eisenhower came in. We always ascribe everything to the Warren Court, which was appointed under Eisenhower. Basically, it was the appointees to the court, the Masons, according to William Still, who wrote the book we have out here called The New World Order, Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, the vast majority of Supreme Court justices who came up with the Engle versus Vitale, which created the wall of separation between church and state, the majority of them were Masons. And that's why the Masons are avidly anti-Christian, at least when you get to the upper echelons of the order. And if you read Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma, you will find out that Christ really is simply another man, another good man, a good philosopher. But Lucifer is the morning star. Lucifer is the hope. And if you read Manly Hall, who is probably the leading occultist in America, he will quite openly tell you that the whole philosophy is that each one of us can become God. Of course, that was the message of the serpent in the Garden of Eden as well, and you know the trouble that got Adam and Eve into. Well, as an offshoot of Masonry came Theosophy, and in 1875, Madame Blavatsky created the Theosophical Society, and you will find many of the people, the key people who played important parts in changing the world came out of that organization. Adolf Hitler read the secret doctrine written by Madame Blavatsky almost nightly. In fact, it is said that back at the National Archives, they have his copy, Adolf Hitler's copy of the secret doctrine with all the margin writings on it. This is what energized the Third Reich. This is what energized Adolf Hitler. And the basic tenet of all of the Luciferians is anti-Semitism. In fact, there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that the protocols, which are the basis of much of modern-day anti-Semitism, were actually originated by the Theosophists and circulated by the Theosophists. And much of the writing within the so-called conservative Christian community today that is anti-Semitic originates with the Theosophists who hate the Jews. Why? Because just the Jews are God's chosen people, and if you can destroy them, you can thwart God's plan. And so it is that the Theosophists are there. Today they operate something called the Lucius Trust. It used to be Lucifer Trust. It was actually formed by Alice Bailey, but they changed the name because Lucifer had a bad name. It's the Lucius Trust, and I take their publications regularly, and they say, oh boy, we've just about got it. The year 2000, the new age comes in. We move from the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarius, and we are going to have the new world order. And then, of course, the Theosophical movement gave rise to the new age movement, and those of you who heard Constance Cumby's talk yesterday, what can I add to what she had to say? These people talk about how the enemy is really the Christ, about how the enemy is really the Christians. The Christians are going to have to be eliminated in large numbers. And they are moving towards the New World Order, and they are all working under the United Nations, and they are all intent upon socialism in America. And as you begin to see then the interplay between these various organizations, you will find that many of the people within the humanistic movement move into the Theosophical and back and forth. Now, you remember I told you that there were two parallel movements. The second one, of course, was the humanist movement that began at the time of the Enlightenment as well. And those, instead of believing in the occult gods, they believed in no god at all. They then gave rise to the socialists. And, of course, the socialist movement was there in Europe at the time of the French Revolution as well. In fact, you remember the flags that the Jacobins carried at the time of the French Revolution? They were red flags. The day that the communists have determined, which will be the holiday for communism, was actually May 1st, the same day that the Illuminati was formed. Probably the best single book on the progress of the ideology of humanism and of socialism is a book written by James H. Billington, formerly with the Library of Congress, and more recently with the Smithsonian Institute. It's a book called Fire in the Minds of Men. And it is taken from Dostoevsky's classic book that tells the story of the time when the revolutionaries had set fire to the building, and the roofs of the building were burning, and everybody was trying to get water onto the roofs of buildings to stop the fire, and somebody shouted, "You don't understand. The fire is not on the roofs of buildings. The fire is in the minds of men." And James H. Billington tracks the course of the humanistic movement from the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, up right up until the present time. An amazing book. Amazing for many, many, many reasons. It goes into all the various secret societies, and yet if you go down to the British Encyclopedia Britannica and you read today, all mention of these, or almost all mention, has been systematically removed. If you get the 1911 British Encyclopedia, you will find a detailed mention of the Carbonari and of the Illuminati. And if you go to the library today, you'll find it's been simply taken out of the encyclopedia, because your reality is to be what you are allowed to read, what you are allowed to think. And tragically, our whole reality has been systematically altered by those who work within the shadows. Even more significant in James H. Billington's book is the fact that he never mentions the secret organization or semi-secret and covert organization that he belongs to, which is known as the Council on Foreign Relations, and he was part of the editorial staff of their quarterly magazine, Foreign Affairs, for many years. How could you write a book about secret societies and never mention the organization you're part of, unless perhaps you're trying to influence the public? But a fascinating insight into the secret societies that were part of the humanistic movement. You must understand that every socialist is a humanist. Every communist is a humanist. Now, not every humanist is a communist, but every communist is a humanist, because there's this common belief in no God and in socialism and internationalism that energizes these people. The first Socialist International was created in 1861 by Karl Marx. Actually fell apart July 4th, 1876. It was the first anniversary of the 100th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The second Socialist International was created in the 1880s, and that second Socialist International then gave way to the Third International. The Third International is communism. Lenin was a communist, but he was also a socialist, member of the Socialist International. And in Trotsky's book on Stalin, he simply tells you that Lenin got together all of his followers and said, you know, these regular socialists are not willing to use the terror and brutality necessary to make a revolution work. What we need to do then is no longer call ourselves socialists, we will call ourselves communists. Everybody said, we're socialists. He said, no, henceforth we'll be communists. And this is, of course, after the first socialist revolution in March of 1917, between the First Revolution and the October Revolution, when the communists took total control of the tragic country of Russia. Well, anyway, you can follow this continuing socialist revolution in Russia, but you can follow the socialist revolution in America as well. Back in 1953, the Congress of the United States was very concerned. We fought a great war to bring freedom to the peoples of the world. But by 1953, Eastern Europe had gone communist. China had gone communist. I mean, literally hundreds of millions of people had fallen under a brutal tyranny. There were congressional investigations at that time, and what they found out, there were organizations in America that were pushing a communist line, and many of them were funded by America's great tax-exempt foundations, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and so they commissioned a congressional committee to investigate. Well, the committee came under tremendous pressure. In fact, there was a congressman who was sent by the White House to disrupt the meetings. His name was Duane Hayes. And in chapter appendix 2, they tell the story of what Duane Hayes did to disrupt the meetings of the only congressional committee ever allowed to look behind the veil and see what America's great foundations were doing. And what happened was that Duane Hayes, in 185-minute period, interrupted the discussions 246 times. In other words, he was there to disrupt the meetings. He did everything he could. And he said openly, I'm here to disrupt the meetings, and I'm going to do it. And he managed to disrupt the meetings, but the committee was eventually able to find out what was going on behind the scenes. Who financed the Kinsey report that led to the sexual revolution, that led to the AIDS epidemic, and the fact that we have 56 million Americans with a sexually transmitted viral disease? Well, the Rockefeller Foundation funded the Kinsey report, which was totally unscientific. Who was it who brought Gunnar Myrdal to America, a Swedish socialist, to write a book, The American Dilemma, that led to the civil rights legislation that allowed a tremendous increase in the power of government over our lives and has begun to create increasing racial divisions within our society to the point where a few days ago when a white policeman shot a black boy, I think it was somewhere in the South, and suddenly there are riots all over the city, the tremendous hatred of black for white wasn't there 30 years ago, but it is now, because these people set out 100 years ago to change America. And basically the book tells the fact that the great foundations have been spending their money to bring socialism to America and to destroy the love which every American should have for his way of life, to go into the great universities and get them to turn their back on their sectarian foundations and embrace the secular philosophy, to rewrite history, to publish the Encyclopedia of Social Studies, where the section on communism was written by a communist, and the section on socialism was written by a socialist, and the section on capitalism was written by a communist. Planted, you might say. An amazing book. Well, anyway, of course, the story of what happened, the committee report was published. They were attacked by all the major means of communication in America. They couldn't get the committee report out. There were a few of them in circulation. I have a man who I have on my radio program named Robert Goldsboro who actually had a copy. Man came to him and said, I want your copy of that committee report. And Goldsboro said, it's not for sale. He said, I'll give you $2,000. Now, Goldsboro was not very wealthy. This was 1958. $2,000 was a lot of money. Goldsboro said, it's not for sale. The man said, name your price. I'll give you whatever you want. I want that report. Well, of course, all the copies were bought up and simply disappeared. Then the book was written by the counsel for the committee, Rennie Wormser. And, of course, they couldn't get it circulated. I talked to the publisher back in 1980. He said, I couldn't get it circulated, so I gave the plates away. He gave them to a gentleman in Southern California who couldn't get it circulated either. And earlier this year, I was given the plates, and we're getting this book out across the country, and we're getting fairly good distribution, because you can't understand anything unless you understand that the people, certain people of great wealth and great power, are actively working to create a socialist dictatorship in America. This book goes into the backgrounds of the First World War. The Carnegie Institute was intent upon bringing America into that war. In fact, if you go back, and I have a filmed interview I did with the chief investigator for this committee, who told about how they had the opportunity of going through the files of the Carnegie Institution in 1909 and 1910 when they were talking about how are you going to change the world? Well, the best way is war. How are we going to get a war going? Well, maybe we can get a war going. How are we going to get a war? How are we get America into the war? That's what it was all about. War was aimed at changing the world, and they sure did change it because they had a different agenda. Now, of course, today, the Socialist International is now the Fifth International, exists, and of course, the leaders of Mitterrand of France belong, the leaders of the Labour Party in Israel belong, the leaders of the Democratic Socialist parties in Scandinavia belong, and in Germany, Austria. The Socialists are working towards a socialist America, and right now we have Bill Clinton in the White House, who surrounded himself with people from the Institute for Policy Studies, which was a Marxist think tank. We have Morton Halperin, he was so subversive he couldn't even get through the Democratic Senate to be an Assistant Secretary of Defense, so now he's in the National Security Council guarding our security. Our chair, the former director of IPS, which incidentally was financed by the World Peace Council, which was financed by the KGB. Derek Scheer, I think, has an ambassadorship someplace. He's one of the key advisors to Bill Clinton. But there is another offshoot of this, and of course this is really one of the most important and significant. And then as a student at Georgetown University, I heard a professor named Carol Quigley espouse the same vision. Well, Carol Quigley is the source of my research, and I've researched him for many years. I went through his papers back at Georgetown before they were ever laundered. I came across this interview with Carol Quigley, which I purchased. It was in the period between 1904 and 1908 when a group came to be known as Milner's Kindergarten. It was made up of people of great wealth and great power, and many of the banking elite of England, met regularly in a group called the Coefficients with the leaders of the Fabian Socialist Movement, because they both wanted socialism and they wanted world government. The background to this is beautifully described in a book called An Experiment in Autobiography by H.G. Wells. And he tells about, for 4 years, they had regularly dinner meetings, the socialists on one side and the corporate socialists on the other. And at that time, of course, in 1908, they broke off. They renamed the group called, came to be known as the Round Table, similar to the art, the Knights of the Round Table. By 1914, their people were in control of the British government. Now, nobody wanted a war, but they wanted a war. They wanted a war because this is how you're going to change the world. If you read the writings of George Bernard Shaw, who is not one of my great heroes, but he will tell you that Edward Grey, or who was actually part of this secret organization, according to Professor Quigley, did everything he could to get the war going. What happened, of course, there was the execution of the Archduke in Sarajevo, and it looked like there was going to be a minor confrontation, but the Kaiser had been promised by the King of England that if there was a war, England wouldn't come into the war. So the Kaiser then was not really reluctant to have a minor border skirmish. That was all it was supposed to be. There wasn't supposed to be a great war, but the English didn't want a minor skirmish. The English had pledged to the Kaiser they wouldn't come in the war. When the war got started, the Germans asked if the Belgians if they could go through Belgium to get into France, because France was ready to attack them from the west, and England said to Belgium, don't you dare allow the Germans to come through your territory. We will back you every step of the way. And the Belgians foolishly believed that. And, of course, to their dismay, they found that English promises are just about as good as Bill Clinton's promises. In any event, as soon as the Germans went through Belgium, England immediately went to war, because there was a treaty back in 1839 that England and that Earl Grey said, you know, if we're going to ever have world law, we've got to honor our treaties. We signed a treaty in 1839 with Belgium. This is 1914. We've got to go to war. And so the war started. And once you unleash war, you never know how it's going to end up. And that's what happened. 30 million people either were killed or injured. And, of course, the war should have been over. Everybody wanted to end the war. The Russians wanted to end the war. The Germans pleaded to end the war every year. The French wanted to end the war. But the English wanted to keep the war going because they wanted to bring America in, because they wanted the League of Nations. And all of these ideas were occultic ideas, the New World Order. This is what it was all about. And, of course, in 1918, everybody was exhausted. There was a revolution in Germany, and that's why the Germans asked for the armistice. And, of course, Wilson had promised peace without victory. You know, we will not punish the people on the other side, and then turned around and ceded to the Versailles Treaty, which did exactly the opposite, which made the basis for the Second World War. The League of Nations, of course, was formed, but America didn't come into it. How are we going to get world government? Well, the background of the Second World War is amazing, and it's beautifully outlined in Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, where you find out that the Round Table people, or by this time they were known as the Royal Institute of International Affairs, but they were still the disciples of Cecil Rhodes and John Ruskin, actually were encouraging Hitler at every step of the way. And you imagine that Hitler, you know, was being appeased. No, they were actually encouraging him. We don't have time because of the limits today, but it is an amazing story which you will never read any other place other than in Quigley's book, where he tells you how the members of the Round Table at each point were encouraging Hitler first to go into the Rhineland, then into Austria, then northern Czechoslovakia. And even though Czechoslovakia was far more powerful than the Germans were, who really did not have much of a military at that time, the English and the French put such pressure on Czechoslovakia that they ceded northern Czechoslovakia to Adolf Hitler. One of the more interesting parts of the whole story is a letter I uncovered going through Colonel House's papers back at Yale University, from the American ambassador to Colonel House, written in 1936, saying, why are American corporations building up the military capacity of Adolf Hitler? I mean, they're building up all of his armaments, and the thing is, they can't get their money out. Do the American stockholders realize that they are building up Hitler's armaments, and they can't get their money out? There's not going to be any profit in it. Well, no profit. But there was a purpose. Now, you have to understand that after the First World War, the English aristocracy met together with the American aristocracy, headed by a man named Colonel House. And they decided to form a organization that would take control of both the British and American governments and move towards a one-world socialist system. In England, it was known as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. In America, it was known as the Council on Foreign Relations. By 1936, it was very powerful. In fact, it influenced most of our major corporations. And if you go into the background of who it was who actually financed Adolf Hitler, you will find it was these major corporations from the Council on Foreign Relations. By 1948, the Council on Foreign Relations was really in total control of both political parties. In fact, since 1948, every presidential candidate, with two exceptions, who has run for office has come from the Council on Foreign Relations. That would be Reagan and Barry Goldwater. Certainly Lyndon Johnson was not a member, although he certainly was surrounded by their people. Every Secretary of State, with two exceptions, has come from the Council on Foreign Relations. The head of the CIA always comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. The head of the Federal Reserve Board always comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. And the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, with the exception of the current one, has always come from the Council on Foreign Relations. And yet most people have never heard of the Council on Foreign Relations. And that's because Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, ABC, CBS, NBC, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, and Robert McNeil all come from the Council on Foreign Relations. And we have, if you doubt this, all you have to do is write to the headquarters of their organization. You write to the director of the Council on Foreign Relations, 5080 68th Street, New York City, New York, and ask for the annual report. They'll send it to you free of charge. And you'll get the current membership list: Bill Clinton, Warren Christopher, Bruce Babbitt, Donna Shalala, right on down the line. We've got the list out there. You're welcome to them. You must understand that these people have a goal and an objective, and that is the establishment of a world government. And they actually believe, if you get into their writings, their inner writings, that there are just too many people on the earth. And if you, the Club of Rome is an international extension of this whole organization. The Club of Rome said in their 1991 release, "In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself." We find the writings, and these come incidentally from Dixie Lee Ray's wonderful book, Environmental Overkill. She quotes from Mr. David Graeber, who says, "Human happiness, and certainly human fecundity, are not as important as a wild and healthy planet. I know social scientists who remind me that people are part of nature, but it isn't true. Somewhere along the line, about a billion years ago, maybe half of that, we quit the contract and we became a cancer. We became a plague upon ourselves and upon the earth. It is cosmically unlikely that the developed world will choose to end its orgy of fossil energy consumption and the third world its suicide consumption of the landscape. Until such time as Homo sapiens should decide to rejoin nature, some of us can only hope that the right virus will come along." Or Bertrand Russell, writing in his book, The Impact of Science on Society, said this: "At present, the population of the world is increasing. War so far has had no very great effect on this increase, which continues throughout each of the world wars. Until the last quarter of the 19th century, this increase was more rapid in advanced countries than in backward ones. But now it's almost wholly confined to very poor countries. I don't pretend that birth control is the only way that population can be kept from increasing. There are other ways which one must suppose opponents of birth control would prefer. War, as I remarked a moment ago, has hitherto been disappointing in this respect, but perhaps bacteriological war may prove effective. If a black death could be spread throughout the world once in every generation, survivors could procreate freely without making the world too full. There would be nothing in this to offend the conscience of the devout or to restrain the ambitious of nationalism. The state of affairs might be somewhat unpleasant, but what of it? Really high-minded people are indifferent to suffering, especially that of others." And this is the byproduct of the mentality that began with the Enlightenment. Now, we don't have time here to show you how this all interlocks with the Colonel House, who formed the Council on Foreign Relations, his tie into the occult. But Constance Cumby gave me some quotations this morning, and perhaps sometime we'll have time to go into that. I want to just tell you, in the few minutes I have left, about the American Stonehenge. In the eastern part of Georgia, on the highest point in the county, there is a gigantic granite monument Nobody knows who put it there. It was erected in 1979, but the plan is laid out. Now, on this blue granite monument, in 12 different languages, including Sanskrit, Babylonian cuneiform, the Egyptian hieroglyphics, classic Greek, English, Russian, Hebrew, Arabic, Hindu, Chinese, Spanish, and Swahili, is listed the plan of the guides. Now, this is a multi-million dollar production. It is the American Stonehenge. And the first plan says, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. There are people out there who would love to see mass extermination. They would love to see the population of America brought down to 2 billion. This is the stated goal of the Club of Rome. This is the stated goal of the New Agers. This is the stated goal of many of the humanists. And they all interlock because they have a common denominator, a hatred of God. What can you do? You can become informed. You can get my tapes. You can get Constance Cumby's tapes from yesterday. You can listen to them. You can get the material, and you can begin to tell others this amazing story. Because if you realize that each one of you just could convince one person a week of what's going on, within a year, everybody in the entire world would know, of this story of the occult forces, this perpetual battle between good and evil that exists today. You must become informed. You must become inform others. If you work within the conventional political organizations, chances are the presidential candidate you vote for will be not the candidate of your choice, but the candidate of their choice. And so I would remind you of the words of James Russell Lowell. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. In that strife of truth with falsehood for the good or the evil side, it is then the brave man chooses while the coward stands aside until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone 'tis strong, though a lot may be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch upon his own. Thank you and God bless you.
Not much time, only about 10 minutes or so. I marvel at this man's memory, but I'd like to ask the first question myself. When you give talks like this, you must be sometimes challenged by others as being an alarmist. And perhaps you could explain how you would go about debating with others, and especially those who disagree with your position on AIDS.
Well, the question is, how do you answer the question that you're an alarmist? Well, I think when the house is on fire, I think that you have to tell people. It really would not be very nice to say, do you smell smoke? Gee, I wonder where that smoke is coming from. This talk is given only because you've had an opportunity to have some background beforehand. If you'd walked into this room cold, I wouldn't have told you most of what you've heard. But having heard my talk on AIDS, having heard Constance Cumby's talk on the New Age, which is incredible, and then understanding how all of these things interlock with all of these various organizations. And then my challenge is, prove me wrong. You know, get the publications, go down to the library, check the recent British Encyclopedia Britannica on the Illuminati and the Carbonari, write to the Council on Foreign Relations at 5080 68th Street, New York City, New York, and ask for the annual report. And if it's true, why haven't you heard about it? Because all of the media in America, for all intents and purposes, control. There are a few small radio stations like my own and like the stations that I broadcast on, and we do 3 hours of radio every day trying to bring this message to America. Oh, well, it's just not enough for me. You've got to do it. You've got to pick this up. You know, remember the poem. Now, to you, from fallen hands we throw the torch, is yours to hold on high. If you betray, you lose faith with us who die, we shall not sleep. Your obligation is to get involved in this battle. That's my challenge. And remember that it's a spiritual battle. And remember what it says in Ephesians 6:13. Wherefore, put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Are you standing? Are you willing to stand? I hope you will. Yes.
Would you turn on the microphone? There's a little switch there. Turn it on, please.
Doctor, as I was saying, I've worked there as a kid in Minnesota, and I don't think my heart is racing this fast ever since I first got involved with work moving back in 1972. I was fortunate enough to hear this story that you just told in the late 70s, early 80s, but you've got more background to and authority with your background to be able to tell it. I remember trying to tell the MCL or the UCLA here this connection before the AIDS thing ever came on site years ago. But my basic questions, and Colonel Archibald Roberts, retired U.S. military from out in Colorado, is the one who led me to understand so much of this whole mess. But my question basically is, between the Masons and the KCs, there's been a lot of what I call ecumenism socializing. Why can't we get through to the KCs that are supposed to be a Catholic spiritual organization, that they're playing with basically the hierarchy of the devil?
Because of the spiritual blindness, because there is a supernatural battle going on as well as the political battle. The devil is working within the Protestant Church, the Catholic Church, because he hates Christianity, everything it stands for. All you can do is just keep trying and just keep praying. And I think prayer is one of our most powerful weapons.
Yeah, I have to say, thank God for a person, Terry Todd, here in the state of Minnesota, who was in a tent. And in the early 80s, when we had a grandchild who needed blood, said, Warren, go to your pro-life
friend,
give his blood.
Thank you.
We have very little time. Please make your point very briefly.
My name is Mary Smith. My question is, I realize you can't help everything you know, but regarding the CFR, Council for Relations, and their involvement of bringing socialism to America and keeping this establishment here, what about the involvement, I'm curious if you also know the involvement with the Colorado Commission and the Georgia Service Society.
Well, they all interlock. I mean, the members of the Bilderbergers come from the council in large part, but they come from other countries as well. They represent the financial elite from other countries, the education elite, the military, and the same thing as the Trilateral. The Trilateral Commission then extended into Japan, and so it was Japan, Europe, and America. That was the Trilateral. The man who created the Trilateral Commission is a man named Brzezinski. And if you read Marilyn Ferguson's book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, she will tell you that Brzezinski's thoughts and philosophies are theirs. In other words, Marilyn Ferguson is the goddess of the New Age movement of today, the Aquarian Conspiracy. She writes from the point of view of a conspirator, and she's saying, you know, Brzezinski's ideas and ours are very, very similar. Yes?
I was one of the people who, I stumbled on something about the Masons, and I thought it was kind of top attack all, who cares about Masons, you know. But then I was reading something about Maximilian Kolbe, and his twofold cause was to defeat Freemasonry and to win the world for the Immaculata. What I thought as he was talking about that, and I have such a high love and respect for him, I realized there has to be more to this, and I did do a lot of this inquiry. I became a history major and read a lot of the material that you're talking about. I know that, you know, so much of what you're saying I can verify. I guess the one thing I'd like to leave people with hope is that what Maximilian Kolbe said to do is to consecrate ourselves to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, and it's that, you know, he wanted to win the world for the Immaculate, and that, you know, if we are to feel calm about this and not feel so hopeless, we have to pray, as you keep saying. And if we consecrate ourselves to Our Lady, we can go through this terrible ordeal with a great deal more peace. And I just wanted to read you that.
Thank you.
Doctor, I was looking at some of the materials you had out there. You mentioned that George Bush was a CFR member, and you talked about there.
He was the director of the CFR, member of the Trilateral Commission, dropped out in 1980 when he ran for Congress, for the presidency.
And the desire of CFR to control population. I guess then asking as a skeptic on a lot of this, although regarding that you have some merit, a lot of merit to what you're saying, but still skeptical on it. But how would you explain George Bush's steadfast opposition to freeing up and allowing abortion, given that he's part of this monolith called CFR?
Well, very, very simply. It's all play acting. For instance, Mrs. Bush was solidly pro-abortion. George Bush was solidly pro-abortion before he began running as a conservative. So much of what is done is simply to create two sides, conservative and liberal, and having fighting against one another and creating leaders for both sides. Today you see the situation where the Democrats oppose the conservatives, homosexuals oppose the heterosexuals, children oppose their parents, women against men, black against white, and you have leaders in each situation. George Bush is an occultist. He comes from a group known as the Skull and Bones, which is goes back in time to the occult societies of the last century, and actually goes probably can be traced indirectly back to the Illuminati. Have you noticed two of his sons now are running for governors, one in Texas and one in Florida? You never heard any of the bad things about George Bush. When George Bush gave his speech, you remember the 1,000 points of light speech? 1,000 points of light is an occultic term. Every occultist knew where that phraseology came from. You can trace that back to Alice Bailey and much of her writings. So George Bush said what you wanted to hear, just as most politicians say what you want to hear. And occasionally they will do what you want. Yet George Bush, for instance, kept John Cormier in the National Endowment for Arts when they were putting out, frankly, pornographic literature. George Bush said the right thing on so many things and did the wrong thing. He didn't sign the treaty in Rio, admittedly, on by biodiversity or whatever it was. But then, of course, he was replaced by Bill Clinton, also run by the Council on Foreign Relations, and Bill Clinton did it. So it really didn't matter. And so all the hard work we did getting George Bush into office has been simply undone. We're told if we can only get the Republican president in, we're going to get a conservative Supreme Court. You know who appointed Justice Blackmun? Richard Nixon. I mean, Sandra Day O'Connor has been really very much of a disappointment, as have so many of the people who've been appointed. But you see, we're always supposed to think we're almost there. Boy, we get Ronald Reagan in, he's going to save America. Ronald Reagan's wife was into frank occultist, Nancy. She was calling her astrologer every week to get advice for Ronald Reagan. And I'm not saying Ronald Reagan was a bad man. I think that maybe his heart was in the right place, but he certainly wasn't a Christian, at least by any manner or means. And he said all the right things, and he talked about the tremendous debt run up by Jimmy Carter. We had a $1 trillion debt when Jimmy Carter had been in office for 4 years. And Ronald Reagan said everything right. And we ended up with $3 trillion debt when he left office. And it's the Democrats' fault? No. He never once put in a balanced budget. He never once used the veto we had to begin doing away with all of this. He never froze government spending. All the things he could have done, he talked about it. He talked a great game. He talked about Star Wars. But we never put in Star Wars. He talked about, the evil empire and ended up embracing Gorbachev. So I would ask you, challenge me. Get hold of Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, 1,348 pages, and read it. Write to the Council on Foreign Relations and ask for their membership, their annual report. They'll send it to you free of charge. And then give me a call anytime if you've got any questions. I don't blame you for being skeptical. Believe me, when I first got started, read the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence. That book changed my life 32 years ago when I found out that the great foundations, the great wealth of the industrialists was being used to bring socialism in America and destroy the free enterprise system.
I wonder if you could shed some light on the New Federalists. It's a newspaper that's circulating around the country. I think DuPont is involved with that, and LaRouche. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be kind of mixed messages because they're
Lyndon LaRouche is one of the most dangerous men in America today. Most of what he says is accurate, but it's sort of like the bait on an end of a hook. You know, it is a worm there and it's nutritious, but if you take the bait, why, the hook's going to get you. Lyndon LaRouche is one of the most dangerous men in America. And he has a tremendous following. He has unlimited funds. Nobody knows where the money comes from. He's recently out of jail. There's a tremendous force behind Lyndon LaRouche. Need I say more? Yes. What's that?
Rush Limbaugh, where does he stand?
Rush Limbaugh is the best conservative money can buy.